Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the 13th night, and we've got four streams tonight. And first it is, in 2 hours from now, there will be Lone Wolf, who is a blogger, then JF Garipi, and then Settlers Lament. But first, it's Horace, and most of you, I think, will be familiar with Horace already. Horace, welcome to Millennial, and could you just introduce yourself quickly for anyone who isn't familiar with you? Please, go for it.
I think you're very generous saying that most people will be aware of me. I think you've got quite a broad audience. But I started making videos last July, prompted by the Tommy Robinson movement's attack on Mark and Shazia and Dion, which that particularly ridiculous video. The video that I put out in response to that, you promoted, and Morgoth and some others, which I was very grateful for. And from there on, I had a few hundred people, and now a few thousand people watching my stuff. And my video's gone BitChute. I got banned off YouTube. If people want to see the videos that I've made, go onto my BitChute channel. It's just called Horace, and you can find out more. You're always welcome to get in touch. And I've got a link tree. I don't know, maybe someone will post that in the chat.
It's linked below for anyone. In fact, I'll link it myself on DLive, but it should be there on YouTube already. Linktree is something I'm trying to encourage people to use because I think it's a good idea. People should be able to find that already. And here it is on DLive. There you go. That's Horace's DLive Linktree. So, all right. I think that we're all set up. So, all right. What kind of topics do you explore in your work? Again, just for people who don't know this already.
Well, if you could just bleep out a bit of my answer. There's some topics that I just won't mention, but apart from that, that question, and the question of the other one, I will have to bleep out as well, but the Rotherham Rochdale type thing. I'm all right at this, aren't I? And my last one was called the Traitor Party. That was about the Tories. I'm probably going to do a second part to that. I'm going to do more on the older Rotherham Rochdale phenomenon. I'm then going to do returning to that question next year, and I've got loads more ideas after that. I do quite interesting conversations about, I'm beginning to do stuff about labour and trade unions and things like that, which I find very interesting, class warfare. I'm not a Marxist myself, but I find it interesting to talk about. I do conversations with Gilad Atzmon, which I've done about four of them, and did an interesting one with Zubida El Arabia the other day. So I'm quite happy to talk to all sorts of people with different perspectives to find common ground. That's generally my approach. I'm more sort of diplomatic than a debater. And it's all about trying to turn people against their common enemies, as I see it. So I have a big focus on turning people against the phony right as well, the fake right, which I think should be seen as our primary enemy, in my opinion. That nothing that we want to achieve can be achieved without defeating the phony right. So I put a lot of emphasis on them. Oh, and I did a series on the Second World War as well. That kind of made a bit of a name for me as well.
Right. And I think you're correct about the phony right, because they are effectively our rivals, although that seems a strange, sort of silly thing to say, but it is kind of the reality. They're the ones that have to be got out of the way so that people will listen to something that is genuinely, conserving the scene in life.
I believe that they deliberately operate as imposters, with varying levels of consciousness of that. But I do believe that the function of the Tory party, the function it serves for the ruling class as a whole, is deliberately to stop us having a conservative party or a nationalist or patriotic party or a traditionalist party. It's to prevent that and to ensure the success of the dissolution of our nation, really, and of all nations. And increasingly the last few months addressing the question of globalism, and I'm increasingly seeing myself as part of a broad, I'm a supporter of PA, but I'm also part of the broader nationalist movement. And in that, I believe I'm also part of an even broader anti-globalist movement. But I've come to see globalism as more and more an important thing for us to focus on, especially this year.
Yes. I agree with you about this. I think there are a lot of people who might not necessarily be nationalists, but they are anti-globalism.
Yeah.
Regardless of your feelings about the nation and even about race, for that matter, I think a lot of people are anti-globalist, and I think that we should be looking for ways to bring all of those groups together and encourage collaboration.
Yeah, if people have watched any of my conversations with Gilad Atzmon, I mean, he's an Israeli guy. Well, Israeli by birth, he's anti-Israeli in his politics, but he's someone who I think would agree with that. I can't see us ever being, I doubt it anyway, being part of the same political organisation as him or anything. It's not like that. We've got different perspectives. He's not a racial thinker. I think he's against that. But he does say that nationalism is a good antidote to globalism, a necessary one, even if he doesn't really adopt it himself. I think that's one example of many different people who we can work with to some extent, even if it's just philosophically. We can work with to some extent to reorient our thinking and to help others reorient their thinking and to form, a sort of a common front and perhaps to wage what we could call class war in a way, but on a global scale and not in the Marxist sense, but against this, what I would say is an emerging global ruling class.
Yeah. I would say oligarchies rather than classes, but yeah, I definitely think that there does need to be what you're saying, an anti-globalist front. I like that idea.
Yeah, I think I mean much the same as what you as oligarchy actually by that. Maybe I'm not using the best term, but oligarchy is a good word actually. Yeah, and especially as that connotes a certain permanency and sort of installing themselves in total self-serving control over the rest of us. So maybe that's a better word for it.
Yeah, somebody in the comments has said, "I'm globophobic." There we go. It's a new word there for us all. All right, so you've got a list of things that you thought we should talk about, and it doesn't begin this year. Although, as you said, a lot of stuff has happened this year and taken shape and fermented this year. But your list begins back in 2016. Obviously, we could go a lot further back than that. Everyone knows that. But we're going to start in 2016 with you in terms of the topics. So, you take it away.
Well, I'd be interested to know what you think of this as well. I think that the EU referendum was immensely significant. I was actually a little bit sort of dismayed when I saw in the couple of years after that. I mean, people like Richard Spencer seemed very sort of dubious about the value of it and whether that had actually been a good thing. I think it's unequivocally a good thing because it's what the Tories and what Labour and the whole ruling class of Britain and of Europe the European Union and of global institutions as well. It's what they didn't want. They absolutely genuinely didn't want it. And people can say that, Brexit actually served the globalist forces in some way. Well, it's not what they wanted. I mean, by all means, once it happened, they will salvage what they can from it. But I think
they can make a practical win out of Brexit in the sense that we're still living in a globalist world,
and they will do that with anything. But
they have had a symbolic defeat.
Yeah,
and that's the thing,
and a defeat, and a lasting defeat, in the sense that it seems to have fomented a rebel spirit.
Can I just point out that exactly the same thing applies to Trump, because Richard Spencer again wanted Trump to fail, to lose this election, because, well, why bother keeping him on? He's only doing what the globalists want anyway, so it doesn't matter whether he wins or loses. That's true. The globalists would make a practical win out of Trump having another 4 years. But it would still have been a symbolic defeat for them to have if Trump had got back in. So I think Spencer was making the very same mistake by supporting Biden a lot that he'd made about Brexit.
Yeah, I do see some sense in what he's saying. I would not go anywhere near as far as to vote for Biden. I think Biden is just an outright enemy of European people. Just absolutely atrocious person.
Absolutely.
And at the head of atrocious forces, even worse, much, much worse than him. And just a scumbag and traitor. And so actually positively endorse them is too far for me. I can understand people not voting for Trump, because it's 4 years of disappointment. And for all that, you know, people can make excuses for Trump, but he did spend a lot of time on the golf course and just messing around and making bad decisions. So he is to blame. And I don't really believe that he tried. Not enough, anyway. Both these things, they were not supposed to happen. And that is a thrilling thing when things like that happen. I mean, I'm so against the status quo that I would even, when I see like the Green Party or Respect winning seats in Parliament, I used to cheer because it just wasn't the blues, reds and yellows. It's, at least it's some kind of chaos. You know, I'm sure a lot of people would broadly agree, you know, chaos helps us, division, you know, sad to say.
The first time I had I think it was the very first time I had Morgoth on, which means that it was the very first stream he ever did, if I remember correctly. And it was about Brexit. It was at that time. And he made the point that Brexit is like the elites going past you in a car and you throw a dog shit into the car through the window and then they've got to deal with it.
It's a lovely image apart from anything else.
Yeah. He said that's what's so fun about it is that it just messes things up for them and then they've got to deal with the result.
And they thought they just had this plush leather interior and suddenly there's pool over it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm imagining a really beautiful throw as well. The window is only open a little bit, just a couple of inches because someone's having a fag. And then a ducky flies in. And splatters against the rearview mirror.
There you go.
I'm glad that Morgoth are on the same side. I just want to say, hail Morgoth! What a guy, honestly. What brilliant content he puts out, and I always enjoy talking to him as well. So these things are to be welcomed. I just, you know, the key things obviously to make the most of them. I saw. The image in my mind, this doesn't really work perfectly as an analogy, but I imagine it's something like, you know, they've put us on a train, maybe to the east. We're being deported to the east. No, they put us on a train, and it's us sticking a stake in the ground and just causing the train to come off the rails or something. It's a bit like that. Maybe I'm exaggerating our power, but also the Brexit referendum stimulated a lot of increase in sort of national consciousness. It's nowhere near as far as what we believe is needed, but it made people think of the nation as something to be preserved. I mean, a lot of people did anyway, but it gave a lot of voice to that. This is what obviously the left and the pro-EU forces find so horrifying, right? Because they were used to us having no voice, just as we don't on immigration, right? And as we know, ever since Enoch Powell, people have just, you know, in huge numbers, but like vast majorities have called for less immigration and stuff. The EU actually wasn't like that. The opinion polls on the EU really, really varied over time. But when the moment came, more than half the voters did the right thing, and that was a delightful and encouraging thing.
Well, absolutely. And I did a series of videos at the time, and not as many as I had planned. I had planned about 16 of them, and I only made 8. It was annoying. It was a technical thing at the time that it doesn't matter now. But one of the points I wanted to make was it bypassed the usual bullshit about democracy, which is party politics. So a working class socialist in the north of England would always vote Labour because his father voted Labour, his grandfather voted Labour, and it was just this unbreakable ancestral link to the Labour Party, this loyalty to the Labour Party, which used that link to completely betray, I mean, to betray these people in the most disgusting possible way, the most evil possible ways. Yeah. It completely despises the white working class. So a voter in the north of England, white working class, would vote Labour all the time against his own interests. And but that's because of party loyalty. A referendum on an issue does away with the parties. The parties are off the table; they don't matter. So then people vote for what they actually want and what is good for them from their perspective. So Brexit suddenly you find out that loads of people were anti-EU when that hadn't really been apparent before.
No, yeah, the polls did not reflect that. It really, like, sometimes support for leaving was as low as, I think, 30% in, like, just a few years before. But, I mean, you know, polls are not really to be trusted very much. But yeah, no, I mean, it's like...
Well, but my point is that you could do this with other issues. You could have referendums or referenda on other issues, and the same thing would happen. I mean, obviously, democracy does have inherent problems, but a lot of the problems come from the party thing, the party system, and the party loyalty. If you just have referendums on issues, then I think you get a far more interesting result. And of course, it's something that then betrays how much the party system distorts things.
Which was what was so horrifying about the fact that we were allowed to vote on it at all. So ever since the referendum, ever since we won the referendum, I still enjoy saying it because I expected they would cheat. But ever since, I've seen all sorts of people. I know people of all different classes, plenty of working class people were Remainers as well, and I've seen loads of them cursing the fact that we were allowed a vote. And it's because things were going their way, basically. You know, they were angry before because the Tories were in, and you know they're always rage because it's strategically useful. But this was real fury because this was things really changing course. I mean, how much remains to be seen. But it was like people were saying, why were we allowed a vote on this? Obviously, they wouldn't have said that if they won. But I was saying, right, so, I mean, they were saying, like, people are not competent to vote on things as complex as this. And I said to them, well, why are they competent to vote on things as complex as a general election? That's the EU is an issue in the general election plus 100 other things. It's far more complex. They're far less competent. But when it's singled out to one issue, you get a clear answer. You at least get people's feelings, even if they, you know, there's a lot of people who are inarticulate or got muddled thinking, but at least you get a real idea of what people think on this. And it's good for the rich.
It's a clear answer. I mean, it might be mistaken. It might be misguided. It doesn't matter. It's a clear answer. If that's mistaken or misguided, then why not the results of a general election?
Yeah.
As you say, that's an even more complex matter. So, yeah, this is why, you know, I, as I said, I have doubts about democracy. But if we're going to have democracy, I think we should definitely have referendums on all key issues. If we're going to do democracy, we might as well do it bloody properly.
And certainly have referendums on the existence of the nation, you know, which is what the EU question concerned, and which all the more so the immigration question concerns. Like, do we continue to have our own homeland?
Precisely.
Precisely.
Yeah. But I agree that it wasn't supposed to happen, and I think it was actually a bit of a mistake for, as he would see it, for David Cameron to promise a referendum on this. I think that was a tactical error that he made, which happened to really, you know, benefit us and everyone else. But I think you're right that if they'd thought about it, they would have found some way to avoid getting into, you know, get cornering, backing themselves into a corner like that.
Well, yeah, although it was an error on his part. I mean, certainly in the sense that it went wrong, but also he was in an almost impossible position because, and I think this is something to emphasise to all defeatists and people who think that, you know, nothing can be achieved electorally. I mean, Nick Griffin is one who's argued that very explicitly. There is no electoral road. I don't know exactly what he means, road to what, but I put this question to him, and I feel that he dodged it when we had him on European Freedom with Simon Harris, rest in peace, brother. He said...
Indeed, I mean, rest in peace, Simon Harris. We should have said that, yeah.
Yeah, I just I haven't got a drink, but I will raise a toast to him again later. He was a great man. But we had Nick Griffin on. He's one person, and other people would argue as well that nothing could be achieved electorally. But no, that referendum, we got that referendum because just a few million people switched to UKIP. That was making the Tory party fall apart. So David Cameron's hand was forced. He had to do something, or more and more of his MPs were going to defect. So UKIP were going to grow either way. So this was basically the best he could do, and it wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
Because he was an arch traitor, David Cameron. He's one of the worst prime ministers we've ever had. And I'm very, very glad that everything fell apart for that piece of crap.
Well, is he? Well, okay, that's an open question, I guess. To me, he just seemed sort of bland and not very competent. But whereas I would say someone like, I don't know, Boris is even more incompetent, but also not bland. He's quite actively treacherous.
Yes, he's an ultra globalist. Yeah. Did you know his father worked for the European Commission?
No, I didn't know that. It doesn't surprise me. I mean, these people are all, they float around in that echelon, and it seems like it's pretty much no holds barred with it. You can be in the charity sector, you can be in a corporation, you can be in a national government, you can be in global government. Mm. It's the sort of
this is why
the management class. Yeah,
they constitute one ruling class, and increasingly it's a global ruling class, and their intention is. Well, maybe I'm projecting, but it's to make serfs of us, to put us under permanent control, and from which we can never ultimately escape, and to blend us all with one another and so on and so on. But no, sorry, maybe I misspoke a bit, but what I mean by Cameron is he was one of the most fake conservatives they've ever been.
Yeah.
He was a leftist, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, obviously he's not a socialist, but he was certainly not a free marketeer either, but that, you know, economics aside, in every other way, he was left wing.
He's the one who brought in gay marriage.
Right. Unforced as well. Completely unforced. That came out of nowhere. I mean, if anything, it just came from America. I think I can't see any other entry point for that into British politics. And nobody supported it. The government got people to support it. But in so many other ways as well. He signed the founding statement of Unite Against Fascism. Did you know that? David Cameron.
No, I didn't know that. No.
this is in my my last video, The Traitor Party. People can find out a lot more. I won't go over it.
We should say, I mean, Unite Against Fascism are basically a communist outfit.
Yeah, Socialist Workers' Party, i.e. Trotskyist Revolutionary Communist Party, they formed them with... several Islamist groups, and I'm not exaggerating there, and I've seen them in action. I went to the English Defence League tried to stage a rally in Whitechapel Road in East London in 2013. I went along to it. They were forced to have theirs across the river, but I went to the UAF. They did a counter demonstration, and it was UAF and Islamic Forum of Europe in conjunction. They're partly merged anyway. UAF incorporates IFE anyway. And IFE is a world-conquering Islamist organization. And the Socialist Workers' Party works directly with them. And also...
It's just incredible. You know,
and David Cameron supported them. Explicitly supported them. He also, in the local elections in, I think, 2011 or 2012, he said, vote anybody except the British National Party. And that includes communist parties. So...
Yeah. I think it's as you said, the fake right is the rival for any sort of genuine nationalism or right wing party. So they want to get rid of their rivals. I mean, yeah, the same in America, of course.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to me the Republicans are even worse. I mean, they're just unbelievably treasonous people, which is despicable. But I focus my videos on Britain mostly. I've touched on American things here and there, but I can't believe the hate. I can't imagine the hatred I would have for Republicans if I was a white American. It's just unbelievable.
Yes,
despicable people. Yeah. So this is something that I focus on a bit. I mean, just about the question of class. I would emphasise again, I don't mean what Marx meant by it. I just mean people who sort of form a certain...
strata.
Yeah, in society, and obviously are opposed to the other strata. Yeah. So what we've seen since the EU referendum, and I alluded to this actually on according to Majid Nawaz on LBC a few weeks ago, as part of our Gropathon. We're doing another one on Wednesday. And... I just said to him, like, what we're seeing in football now represents this division that I believe really, really deepened in 2016. Maybe it was there before, but it certainly really, really became emphatic in 2016. It's now affecting football, which is great, which we should stoke as much as possible. Whatever can turn football fans off football, or not off the actual kicking around, but against the football institutions, Premier League, Sky Sports, BT, and so on, whatever we can do to turn football fans against them and against the players, because the players are the ones politicised, or leading the politicisation in some ways. That is great. And the call into Magic was about the Millwall fans booing. Unfortunately, not many other people have done it, but at least they did. And it was a call in about that. And I was just saying, what we're seeing here really is a division among the fans, because there's a lot of wet sort of Antifa type fans as well. It's really, really cringeworthy, the kind of people who are into football now, especially Arsenal, and they're some of the very, very worst, the most embarrassing fans of all. And we're seeing a division between them. And on the one side, you've got rebel fans who are basically patriotic, got some degree of sort of ethnic consciousness. And on the other side, you've got the rest of these sort of Antifa leftist football fans who are just a complete embarrassment. Plus, you've got the league, you've got all the TV companies, you've got most of the players and so on and so on. And it ain't going away, right? I don't see how they can get away with it. I don't see how they can get rid of this problem. If players insist on kneeling, which they will, which they do, and they're going to do for a long time, and if fans want to come back and watch the games and they want to make their feelings heard, that division is going to grow and grow. We should stoke it in any way we can. It's if people turn off of football, we really can take our country back. If they don't, maybe we can't. I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit neat there, but, you know, if we can ruin football, the football institutions, we can have our country back. Like, seriously, it's as big as that.
Yeah. Did you say this started in 2010?
What, with the football problems in particular?
Yeah.
The deepening politicisation I first noticed in 2010 when the Tories got back in.
But, right, that's what I was wondering about, because you've said in the notes that an increasing politicisation that you first noticed in 2010 massively escalated in 2016. I think it's it's interesting because I have said many times, and I still think this is true, that the 2000s was a very bland decade, even though it had 9/11 at the start of it. The Iraq War and Afghanistan. But in terms of culture, not much seemed to happen. And in terms of politics, not much seemed to happen. It's very strange to me, you know, that this new century would begin, this new millennium would begin, and you'll remember that there was a lot of fanfare, you know, 1999, oh, it's a new age and all that. Mm-hmm. And then it happened, and it was just like a decade of emptiness.
Amazing. I'm struck that you say that. I've never heard anyone else say that, and I felt the same, or I feel the same on reflection. The 2000s for me, I mean, partly for my own reasons, seemed to pass by without hardly anything interesting happening. It really is amazing. It's kind of a blur.
It was a crap decade to have your 20s in, because there was nothing going on. I mean, like, you know, there was no movement, no pop culture phase or anything, nothing. So it's just really,
There was sort of a lack of conflict, and I think that's deliberate. I think the way that Blair and Brown ran the country, they did an amazing propaganda job of portraying themselves as neutral, as middling managerial people, to the extent that loads of people, loads of theorists and stuff, called it that we're now in the managerial era. I think Paul Gottfried spoke about that. He's actually far more sophisticated. He's written some really interesting things, but he touched on that sort of therapeutic managerialism. And what it does is it soporifies, I don't know if that word, but it has a soporific effect on everyone. And it makes them think that many... And it makes people believe that a lot of the, quote, old, quote, conflicts have been resolved. And it was bullshit, but it really did seem like that for a while. And it seemed like economics was the main thing to care about. And obviously, the phony right are complicit in that, quite by choice.
Very much, very much. But I agree with you that it seemed like from now on things are managed, and so it's not a matter of serious ideological disagreements or anything. It's just a matter of discussing which tactics to employ in this situation and in this situation in order to manage these different situations, not to change them, redirect them, revolutionize them or whatever. It's just everything is management. And I think that Tony Blair, it's ironic that he skillfully crafted that cloak for himself and maintained it, because in reality he was actually quite a revolutionary prime minister in the sense that he hugely transformed Britain. Now, yeah. Not just demographically, but also in other ways. I mean, I think he brought in that sort of common, what we now would refer to wholesale as that common purpose mentality, which, and I'm not even saying that I believe that theory, although I think it probably is true, but doesn't really matter. I'm just using it as a catch-all term. He brought that common purpose mentality into every area of the public sector across the whole country, which, on the one hand, that was a sort of revolution, but it then results in this stagnation where there are no ideological disagreements anymore. So it's kind of weird. But of course, then by bringing in mass immigration, you set the stage for future disagreements of a very, very serious kind. But that's kind of by the by.
Well, I think that is important, yeah. But I think the presumption of people like Blair, if they were really thinking 20 or 30 years ahead, I think the idea was that everything else they did, their control of the institutions would ensure that all popular resistance to immigration would be defeated. And they may yet be proven right on that. I mean, we're a growing movement, but we ain't there. We ain't in the position to stop what they're doing yet. And of course, immigration now is about as high as it's ever been, and as about as non-white as it's ever been. And, you know, I can understand why people criticise sort of Farage. Well, yeah, rightly criticise Farage for that. But yeah, just about the apparent blandness but actual revolutionariness of Blair and Brown. That's one thing Peter Hitchens is really good at. He's written very good critiques of Blair, saying, and of the perceptions of Blair, saying, no, this man was not, he's not a traitor to the left. What he did was he strategically gave in on the economic questions to win on what he saw as the more important questions, to carry through a radicalism that nobody was equipped or to anticipate or resist. And he did it, and it worked. And now we have what Bowden called left-wing capitalism, right? So we've still got capitalism. The proper left lost in that sense, but they won across the board apart from that. So left-wingers control virtually every institution in Britain, and pretty extreme left-wingers, including things like UK Heritage or English Heritage, which was set up by Thatcher.
You probably heard about the statues women.
Well, there was the acid and stuff.
Yeah. And now we don't need to go into her particular attributes, just to say that she was explaining to people publicly how to do permanent, irreversible damage to statues. And she was employed by a museum who eventually fired her, to their credit. But I think only because it was a PR disaster.
Yeah, it's too overtly criminal, basically.
Yeah.
They might have become liable, perhaps. So maybe it was just that.
I think they just didn't want to be associated with that. I mean, it's reputational suicide, but the point is that such a person was in that sector at all, exactly. And even had it written into her contract that her work at that museum would involve, you know, the usual Marxist crap, questioning power structures and all the rest of it.
That's right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, she actually had that specified. Yeah, critical theory is part of my role, and it's my right to carry out. Yeah, and they signed that contract. The other party signed that contract. So
yes, the museum signed that contract. Right.
So yeah, I mean that just says it all. And obviously the willingness of the fake right to just leave all these institutions in place, and the people who Blair and Brown appointed, this whole new class of sort of bureaucrat, corporatist, managerial types, whatever you call them, that is obviously further evidence of the treason of the fake right. And I would just say to everyone out there who's doing tweets, I do it and I see other people doing it, just saying all of this under a Tory government with an 80-seat majority, keep pushing that meme. That is that is digging under the enemy's walls. That's great, because, you know, well, it's just as plain as can be. I mean, the Tories are in government. They can pass any law they want, and we still have the Human Rights Act, the Equalities Act, all these bodies, Ofcom, BBC, it's all untouched by their choice.
Yes. Just to take you back to 2010, because the point I wanted to make, and we're really jumping around the timeline here, it's not what I intended. Sorry about that, everyone. But so then 2000s was this sort of empty decade. Then 2010 came. Now, someone pointed out that there was the global financial crisis at the end of that, 2008-9. That's true. And climate change was also a thing as well. But climate change, I don't know. Yeah, okay. All right. But the point I was going to make was that in 2010, as a response to the global financial crisis, Occupy Wall Street happened. And that was the first time that I felt like this is a political, and I wasn't on their side, I wasn't a leftist, but still, I thought, suddenly there's political activism going on. Because for 10 years, there was nothing like that when I was at art college. Nothing. Nothing to latch onto. And I probably at that age, I would have latched onto that. If when I was 18, I probably would have latched onto an Occupy Wall Street type thing. But there was nothing like that going on. And as I say, it suddenly started in 2010. And I think that started off that decade, the 2010s, because that's when so much happened that you and I are aware of, that, you know, the online movement. And that then brings us to 2016 and so on. But yeah, I just wanted to make that point that it interests me that you pinpointed 2010 as the juncture when politicization sort of reignited.
Do you know what else that is as well? And this again sort of shows the skewed nature of our politics. But 2010, but until 2010, I was a big fan of Stuart Lee. I thought he was a brilliant comedian. And then in 2010, when the Tories got back in, he became political and he became rubbish. And he's just cringeworthy now. Another example was Jeremy Hardy, who I'd always found quite funny. He's very hard left. He's dead now, but he was very hard left. And in 2010, I went to Glastonbury. And I didn't really, really appreciate it at the time, but it's a very left-wing festival, of course. I get that now. But I was in the comedy tent and Jeremy Hardy came on and just, you know, a series of 20 jokes or whatever. Every punchline was basically just the Tories. And I was like, this isn't comedy. This isn't funny. But the left, right, I noticed this on Facebook as well. Suddenly, loads of people I never saw talking about politics, suddenly they were into politics because the Tories had got back in. And at the time, you know, I didn't like Cameron, but I was like, well, at least it ain't Labour sort of thing. And I just thought, why does politics start again? Why does politics die down when the left are in power and it starts again in 2010? It's because things are always drifting their way. And under the Tories, they drift their way a little slower or something, you know? So that's a sign of the deep power of the left and the superficial power of the right. That was a real signifier for me, even though I'm talking about, you know, really minor things, but it made it clear to me that suddenly politics is back.
And of course, you're right. And I remember them saying in 2010, the same kind of stuff that they now say about Boris, that David Cameron, this is a far right government. This is a far right racist government. And, you know, you look for, you say, well, where's the evidence? What are the characteristics of it that suggest that it's far right? And of course, they can't, but they are convinced, the left are convinced that David Cameron was some kind of, you know, Mosleyite figure, and Boris Johnson is, you know, virtually Hitler. And it's amazing to me how they managed to convince, but I guess they're, you know, taking part in workshops and they're just clapping to this rhythm together that, yeah, it's all the far right everywhere.
Oh, well, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, you've mentioned on a couple of your streams recently that you're increasingly interested in psychology. I would love to see a sort of in-depth discussion of the psychology of that, because psychology of the left and of the right are clearly very, very different. But I don't really have a clear idea of what the difference is, but I can tell that it's different, right? Gilad Atzmon said that what the left and the right are fundamentally different things. It's not that they're too... I'm paraphrasing, actually. I'm putting words into his mouth. But it would say, no, it's not just simply that these people were two sides of the centre, you know, either side of the centre, and they have the same issues, but on this side, these guys are all, you know, think one thing and the other guys think the opposite thing. It's not like that. The left represents a fight, well, an unwillingness to accept reality and to force reality to bend to the way they think things should be. Whereas the right is philosophical. It is concerned with what's true and real, and it largely bases its ethics on that. I don't know if that's not necessarily a particularly original thing to say, I don't know, but I think it is very true. And thus, when leftist politicization is a psychological effect, and it's a kind of a crowding effect. They crowd in on each other, and they pressure each other into, I would say, like sort of new kinds of hatred all the time, and fury, and a desire to destroy it. And it's really not the same as right-wing people. Right-wing people, I mean, unfortunately, on the right, you get this complacency, which is just terrible. But they're profound differences. And if you can explain that in psychological terms, I'll be very interested. So I don't know if you're going to do a video on that at some point, but I'll be very interested.
That's the kind of thing that I used to attempt back in 2014 and 15. But eventually I felt that maybe my answers were getting too simplistic, that I was resting on my laurels, and also that I'm no longer in touch with leftists. So yeah. I'm guessing. And so I thought I should stop doing this kind of thing, because I'm not in a position to, I might well be wrong about it all.
I mean, they do it all the time, don't they?
Of course, and they get it wrong. So yeah,
completely wrong.
Yeah. I would say something like, just off the top of my head, I would suggest that the left is a sort of stunted, that they're still infantile in a certain way. Yeah. But so they're utopian, but also always huffy that the world isn't perfect, because their parents haven't done everything that they would have wanted them to do. But that's kind of, I don't know, it just feels patronizing. It feels like there must be more to it than that. That's what I mean.
Yeah, you don't want an overly neat or all. Yeah, you don't want to make a sort of self-serving explanation. You actually want to get to, which is why you're a right winger. That's exactly what Atman's saying, right? It's, you know, you're philosophical. You wouldn't be satisfied to just put out something that successfully canes them, but doesn't tell the truth. You want to tell the truth as well, right? That's a right wing trait. So that's why you are where you are.
yes, and I think, but you see, I think there are even leftists who are concerned with the truth, you know, so it's not like there are some, and you can see that they are, their conscience is troubled by things like mass immigration, because they can see that it's causing problems, but they don't know what to do. There's nothing that they can do about it, because their other convictions can force them to approve of it. Even though they can, at the back of their mind, there's this awareness that this is going to be fucking terrible in the future. So I think that it's not only right wingers who are committed to the truth. I think that's a comfortable thing that we might tell ourselves. But I've seen, like, I'm very wary of cozy theories like this. Yeah. That it always seem to benefit the person who's telling them. So the right wing will say, well, you know, the right wing people have a conscience, whereas left wing people are prepared to do extreme things to get what they were prepared to murder whole millions of people. But we would never do that. And well, how do you know that no right wing person would ever do that? I don't know.
Let's not become sort of smug and self-exculpatory and so on. Yeah, let's not do that. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I agree.
The main thing is there's this theory among some right wingers. This is what I'm really referring to. There's this theory that the leftists are basically insane because their stuff doesn't add up. No, it doesn't. But actually, everyone has desires that contradict each other. You know, that's just a thing. It's mm-hmm. a part of human nature that you want things that cannot coexist. So the fact that the leftists typically want that actually is not a sign of insanity. And it's a huge shortcut for us to say, well, guess what? The reason for this conflict is that we are sane and those who disagree with us are insane. And if they could just not be insane, then this conflict wouldn't exist, but it does because they're insane and we insist on being sane. Ah, come on.
Yeah, and I wonder if the right already went through that illusion on a big scale. I wonder if that's how the Tories became the way they are. You know, not necessarily the Tory leadership, but the Tory members all around the country who, you know, even now continue to vote for all this treason. I wonder if they have gone through the same sort of thing process and ended up in that terrible dead end of saying, well, it's just daft lefties, but, you know, this daftness will blow over. You know, it's just a phase. I mean,
you're absolutely right. That's another thing altogether. That's a separate matter, but you're absolutely right to bring it up. The right likes to think that the left are just sort of silly.
Yeah.
And this time and again, this is how the right sets itself up to be, screwed. completely yeah. screwed, because the left are not joking. Even if you think it's funny, like, you know, drag queens, gay marriage, even if that looks absurd to the right winger who's entertaining it as a future prospect, yeah, it might well be absurd, but guess what? It's a future prospect just now. 5 years from now, it's going to be the law. It's going to be reality. And time and again, that is exactly what's happened, because the right didn't take it seriously. It's amazing how often this happens.
Yeah, yeah. There's one thing that I would give credit to Margaret Thatcher for is that she had this, she said once, Marxists get up early to achieve their schemes. We must get up even earlier. And she did. She literally lived on 4 hours sleep a night, sometimes even less. She did that for exactly that reason, and she really meant it. And she achieved things. She did knock the left back in various ways.
She did. I think she, unlike any of the Tory prime ministers who have followed her, I think Margaret Thatcher, for all her flaws, and I'm not a fan of hers, but what you can say for her is she did understand that there is a fundamental disagreement between the left and the right. Yes, we can reach civilized agreements on this or that, but there is a fundamental difference in mentality between the left and the right. I think she understood that, and understood that it meant war, really.
Yeah, yeah, and it literally did in 1982 as well, yeah. So, I just watched a very, very interesting series that the BBC put out. It's amazingly good considering some of the, you know, appalling stuff they put out. It's called Thatcher, A Very British Revolution, and the first few episodes are the most interesting, I think. There's five in total. And in the first one, it's a fight with her own party. And because her party, under all the previous prime ministers since Winston Churchill, had all agreed that you have consensus politics, compromise politics. And she said, look, that is ruining our country. And she fought her own cabinet on it. And most of the time for the first few years until the Falklands, she had in the cabinet of, I don't know, 20 odd people, she had six people on her side, and even some of them were trembling. But she fought anyway, and that you know, there's, you know, whatever we think of her as a whole, there's a lesson there. It's be prepared to fight the left, not chuckle at them, not be a Sargon, you know, chuckling while they're destroying us, while they're promoting transgenderism to children and so on. Or I see all these other channels like ex-army Paz. There's loads of them, and it's just daft lefties, daft. Oh, they're winning. The left are winning. We're not.
Yeah. I remember in 2014 or maybe 2015, something like that, there was a guy called Derek Turner who, what was it? Was it Amren? There was some conference and somebody interviewed people at the conference. One of them was Derek Turner, who at the time was, I think, editor of the Quarterly Review, something like that. And he was a publisher and author and commentator. And he made this point that the left can be seen as a clown with a knife, in the sense that it's a bit funny and wacky and all that, but it is holding a knife, and it will use that. It's going to use the knife. And so if you approach it just as a sort of jokey figure, you're going to get hurt. And it happens time and again. The right think, oh, it's, you know, it's nothing serious. And then 10 years later, they've lost that thing they cared about.
And if anything, the funny side of the clown acts as a seductive force. It draws you closer to the knife, you know?
Yes.
It subdues your resistance.
Yeah, so, I mean, time and again, you see conservatives talking about the left like a sort of errant, amusing, but slightly annoying child. But it gets strange notions into its head, but you know, just got to keep it on the straight and narrow. But no, the child is in charge. That's the actual situation. It's not, it's not random ideas that go nowhere. There is a lot of, there's a whole mentality behind it.
The so-called child happened to have a 70-year plan, and they carried it out, and now they're eating the fruits, and we're starving. Yeah. I argued at the end of my last video, the one called the Traitor Party, that all through the video I'd said, you know, the left, the right, you know, the fake right gives in to the left in this way, this way, this way. And then at the end I said, I just want to clarify what I mean by the left. I don't believe that David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson are left-wing per se. What they are is people who see left-wing beliefs as serving a necessary function for the global elite that they increasingly consider themselves to be part of, and that is to liquidate everything solid in society, especially the family, traditions, the existence of nations, and so on and so on. Everything that stands as an obstacle to the global farmer turning us peons into livestock and using us as livestock and slurry and pouring us into any vessel they want. Leftism serves as that liquefying force.
That's really good. Yeah, I mean, it's gross, but it's a good analogy. I think that's exactly what I've been seeing this as, and this is why, you know, if like me, you have a certain revulsion against nihilism, then this new situation that we're heading into should really scare you, because, as you've said, it's serfs that they want us to be, also just a kind of human stuff, human sludge that can be poured into whatever structure they need. They need them in.
They make us plastic, or liquid, whatever sort of analogy you want to use, but something to make us moldable. Just whatever puts us into servitude towards them. I think the film Elysium. I think it wasn't a very good film, but it was not a great film. Kind of stupid, but the analogy that it laid out was pretty accurate. I think that is what a lot of the rich and powerful now envision, that they will be a class of people literally above the rest of us, like living on a sort of space platform built around the Earth, and they'll be completely physically free from the danger that we present to them. But what is good, what's encouraging, is that they do see us as a danger, and we keep giving them new reasons to, like the referendum.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a conflict. You know, they're going to see signs from the other side of aggression and a desire to survive. So yeah, I think but you're right that they are scared of us. I mean, you know, the one of the really good memes on our side is that one that says, "If the situation was hopeless, their propaganda would be unnecessary." And I think we should always take heart from that, because clearly they are very worried that their ideas, their plan will all fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why is there a need for organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and so on and so on? You know, these things that just exist to basically terrorize and deny us our rights, often in, you know, snide, sneaky ways. But yeah, not only that, but that what do you call it, an aphorism, is that right? Or a meme, yeah. It's I think the word is apodictic. It's literally just undeniable logically, like that you know, that propaganda exists because we're a threat. There's no other reason for it to exist. So yeah, it's absolutely right. Although obviously we want to be more than merely not hopeless, don't we? We want to be so full of hope and strength that we actually overcome them and defeat them and bring them what they deserve. That's my vision anyway.
Indeed. I think we should maybe move forwards to COVID now. So, because your notes that's the next issue there. Let me see where have I got. Yeah, here you are. So, okay. Normies notice anti-white adverts. So do many non-whites. And did you want to talk about that?
Well, that was sort of a continuation of what I said to Majid Nawaz, which was that I used football as an example, but the class division, let's say, leavers versus remainers became a deep and enduring division that I think will still continue. So maybe the next 5-10 years, I'm not really sure. But not only that, it's also spread out across nearly every other issue in society. And yeah, like, I mean, non-whites in adverts being forced into adverts. I'm seeing even black people like complaining about that, or at least like saying, what's up with that? You know, I mean, not necessarily threatened by it the way we are, but I'm seeing all sorts of people pick up on that. My parents picked up on it, and they are docile, but they picked up on that. all sorts of people, and it's, you know, this.
I've just got this idea of a black guy watching TV and seeing all these race mixing ads where it's a black guy and a white woman, and he says, where do black women at?
Well, yeah, I mean for people who have, you know, for blacks who have racial consciousness, they're not going to like that either. I mean, it's a less of a problem for them if the man is the black one, because he can breed and then run, you know. I'm not accusing anyone of that, but
but it is also an insult to them, isn't it? Because it's saying you shouldn't care about your race, at the same time as they're being told that they should care about their race.
Right.
It's an open contradiction for them. You know, at least for white people, we are never told that we should care about our race. So then it's not a contradiction for us to then be told to race mix. But for black people, it is a direct, obvious contradiction.
Although I imagine, you know, the average black might be less troubled by logical contradictions than the average white. But all the same, some are. And I think the more astute of them are picking up on the fact that, like, I mean, right, beginning to ask the question of who is doing this. I mean, you know, let's not go there. But well, that's not the, you know, that thing is not the whole answer anyway. There are white leftists and all sorts, or just white business people. White, I mean, my goodness, I work in the corporate world, and the prevailing attitudes among just ordinary white business people who aren't politicized are still really politicized now, especially in race and gender.
Oh, God. Well, this is one of the triumphs of the left, to make the non-political world extremely politicized along their lines. So, in other words, their views are considered not political, but just common decency, just goodness. And so, by default, therefore, anything, and that means that they can be constantly propagandizing their ideas, their political ideas, without it seeming like political propaganda. But it also means that anything opposed to those ideas is by definition considered evil.
I agree, and that's such a coup. I would like to ask you, what do you think? I mean, this year we've seen corporations become political like never before, especially in support of Black Lives Matter, certainly with the rainbow flag thing. What do you think is the you know, what function do you think that serves for corporate leaders or for corporate owners? Or I'm not really sure who's driving it, but who do you think drives it, and what is their main motivation for that? Because I don't think profit alone explains it.
No, it's got nothing to do with profit. I don't believe for a second. I mean, this is the kind of thing that libertarians will say, that, oh, well, they're doing it for profit. Or they'll then say, but it won't work, so go broke,
oh, God.
Which is just the most awful cope. No, I don't think it's for profit. And I also think it's probably a mistake to think that there's any one main cause. I think it's everything. It's that directive is coming to the corporate manager from every angle, from his training, from the PR people, from his management, his superiors, from his underlings who are fresh out of university and, you know, being paused up there. And it's what his rival corporations will be doing. So it's just the thing to do. It's just literally, it's like the color of the water that he's swimming in. It's not, it's, I think it's just everything, everywhere. So I don't think there's any one particular reason that you need to zero in on. The issue really is that it's the entire culture which compels the corporate, the yuppie of today to be a leftist or to act on behalf of the left.
I mean, again, it's
a huge coup for them. You know, this is what they've done. As we said a couple of minutes ago, they've made it so that their ideas are really the way to get ahead in life.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's such an effective thing for them to have done. Yeah. I dispute one point though. I mean, well, not dispute it, but I think it can't be the full answer. I mean, as you said, it's hard to make one full answer to what I asked, but it's not the whole culture. I mean, why are they not? I mean, I suppose we said it's not about profit, but I was going to say that, you know, there's a large section of society that really doesn't like BLM. I mean, maybe a majority, it's hard to know. All the rainbow flag or all this. I mean, even those of us who've got, you know, I've got gay friends. I want them to be honest, you know, not assaulted and not persecuted, but I don't support what we call LGBT, right? So I don't like the rainbow flag and stuff. Why is it that those of us who are against these things, who might be a majority, have no voice corporately? I mean, do you remember the day when all the tea companies, like all the, like the big five tea companies in Britain, all declared war on Laura Towner in one moment, like within an hour of each other? Hilarious in a way, except that she can no longer drink her favourite tea. But there you go, she's sorted that problem out in another way. So everyone go buy some Grandma Towners, by the way. But yeah, like, I mean, that was one just very small example. Of many others, of just unity among the corporations. Well, why is there not some profit, and I mean the term loosely, to be had in just a couple of companies breaking away from it? A couple of big ones, I mean.
Well, they'd have to be big enough to survive the backlash.
Hmm.
That's the thing, because there would be one fucking hell of a backlash. Completely orchestrated, obviously, but still.
There would, yeah. I mean, yeah, no, they would come under the same kind of pressure as political dissidents do. Yeah, they would. I mean, they'd find all their suppliers suddenly cutting them off, and it would be a disaster. So, yeah, there's the answer to that. But just about the motivations of corporations in supporting these, in many cases, extreme left aims, Jeff Bezos, not only Amazon, but Jeff Bezos himself and his wife have chosen to send huge amounts of their own fortunes to BLM and other things and other sort of what they call anti-racism. We all know what it is, really. And, you know, as people, they've chosen to do that as well.
Yeah, and I don't think that's just for virtue signaling. I think that's part of what was said. One of the millennials, I've forgotten which one it was, but we were talking about, it was with Frody Midyard's millennial, where we were saying that when you're at a certain level of wealth, you start thinking not about profit or, you know, gaining even more money because you've already got all the money you could ever want or need. But instead, you start thinking about how to reshape the world. So like a James Bond villain kind of thing, or indeed a well-meaning philanthropist from the Victorian era. They did it in a nice way. A mixture. But still, I think it's the same way with Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and stuff. They're thinking, well, okay, I've got immense amounts of wealth, which equals power. When am I going to start using it? Why am I not using it? Why not use it? You know, and I think any human being of sufficient intelligence would think like that. Because, you know, if you were of low intelligence, you'd think, I've got so much money, I can buy more Swedish bimbos than I will ever need or want. It's just fantastic. So I'm going to buy another 1,000 of them this week and another 1,000 limousines that I don't even want or need. That's what an idiot would do with loads of money. But an intelligent person would be thinking, okay, how can I change the world with this? So I think it's kind of inevitable.
Doesn't this say to us something? I would say this is somewhat a repudiation of anti-capitalism or of other views like that, left-wing sort of economic views and stuff. Does this not tell us what you just said? Does this not tell us something about the relationship of money and power, that ultimately power is more profound, I think? Money is instrumental, but power is, you know, money gets you things, allows you to obtain things. But once all those things are satisfied, it turns out people also want the power to control other people, to treat them, as I said, as livestock. I've always thought that power is more profound than money.
I agree with you that power is more profound than money, but I think it doesn't necessarily result in people wanting to treat other people like livestock. I think it can also be quite a benign desire just to improve the world as they see it. But it depends on the ideas that they are immersed in when they go to their, you know, Davos, whatever. The ideas that are going to be circulated there are effectively veiled forms of, we've got to make the public livestock.
Yeah, I suppose it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, because obviously, I guess this is a stupid thing to say, but I imagine that if I suddenly had $100 billion, I wouldn't be like Jeff Bezos. I would support nationalism and things like that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just deluding myself. But I think I would, or I would do what I could for the you know, resisting what I see as evil. And then there's also people like Bill Gates, where maybe I don't watch enough of him, but he seems genuinely, it's really, really hard to tell whether he's evil or mad. I mean, maybe it's both, but...
Do you see, I've said this before, but I'll say it again. My favourite meme, or from the whole COVID thing, not my favourite meme, but it's not funny, it's scary, and it's Bill Gates. It's a mural. I think it's actually a real mural that somebody graffitied onto a wall, and it's Bill Gates holding a syringe, and it says, "Time to install your update." It's so gross. It's so unsettling.
See, that could be happening right now. People taking the vaccine could be having some sort of ultra micro, you know, Microsoft chip. Yeah. Well, I'm being silly, but, you know.
Being upgraded to Windows Vista.
God, yeah. Who remembers that day? I don't think I read Vista. I went from 7 to 8, but 8 was crap as well.
Yeah, well, we're maybe showing our age by with these references, but Windows Vista was, I think it was about 2006 or 7, and it was absolutely awful compared to the, So anyway, but the, yeah, that was a scary, and so you were saying about Bill Gates, is he mad or evil?
I mean, you'd have to know his mind to really answer.
You would. But, you know, on suspicion, I think he's probably... I don't know, because there's a certain goofy tendency to him as well, which implies that... I don't know. I think probably, if I had to guess, I think I'd probably say mad, actually. Lacking social intelligence. I think he seems like a kind of bit of a Sperg. I'd say probably mad more than evil.
And sort of mad in ways that manifest with a lot of evil effects, I'm sure. But, you know, not necessarily intending to actually subjugate all of mankind or whatever. But, you know, we could be wrong. But, I mean, I lean that way as well. There are other people. I mean, George Soros, I do think of as... I think of as an evil person. I mean, we've got presumably completely different perspectives on the world, and he really does see the existence of white societies as a threat. But I mean, I see him as definitely more evil than Bill Gates, and Bill Gates is, you know.
Yes.
And there's others, you know, like, well, a lot of the, you know, those kind of billionaires are more malevolent, I think. But,
I think that George Soros is, I would agree with you. He's not mad.
Very intelligent.
I'm sure he will be. And I think that, he's just simply evil.
It really seems so.
I would think so. I mean, we could go through all these different billion. I mean, what about Jeff Bezos? Mad or evil? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, tending towards evil, I think, because the things that he promotes, they are nasty things. I mean, Bill Gates, you know, he does seem to fit within the term philanthropist. Whereas Jeff Bezos, I see as some kind of sort of globalist activist in a way, or something, anti-national activist, or something. I don't know.
You can imagine him if he was in a film; he'd be played by Ben Kingsley. You know, some dark role like that.
Well, since you've said that, can I just do a Ben Kingsley quote?
Yeah, it's not Gandhi, is it?
Well, I haven't seen Gandhi, so no, I've not seen many of his films. I've seen Schindler's List, which is a bit boring and not very quotable, but it's another one. I want to see if the audience get it within a few words. Because where there's a will, and there is a fucking will, there's a fucking way.
Right.
There's always a fucking way. It's not only him, it's three different people say it, but...
Oh, but what film is that from? Or do you want the audience to guess?
Grief got it straight away.
What is it?
Yeah, Grief is Sexy Beast, yeah.
Oh, right. I know the quote, but I haven't seen the film.
It's a pretty good film. It's not like genius, but it's good. Very good in it. He's very menacing.
All right. Okay, well, to return to... that was... just before we go on, Sexy Beast was... there was something significant about that. Was it early 2000s or 2000, something like that?
Something... 2001, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading about... I read something about it the other day, and it was... I forgot what it was. It was the director. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I was reading about the director and that film was meant. Okay. All right. So we'll return to the notes. And you want to talk about... Okay, so unfortunately, COVID has provided a new way to unify people in obedience. I agree with you. And it has been said already on Millennial, but do you want to give your own perspective on that?
Okay, well, I was interested to see whether you agree with that. I mean, you know, there's people who are rebels, you know, on things like Brexit, but who are still completely obeying all the COVID restrictions. I'm a little sort of disappointed at, obviously we've had effectively, I mean, I'm in a tier four area, effectively this is a third lockdown. And to be a bit cliched, you know, they said 2 weeks to flatten the curve back in March, so... And I'm seeing people obey this one almost as strictly as the first two. And I think, you know, I had hoped and assumed that the more the more authoritarian, well, sort of the more they keep using this lockdown thing and this, you know, don't see your own family on Christmas Day and all this. I thought that a lot of people would rebel, and I don't see much evidence that they have. I hope that they will rebel on New Year's Eve, but it doesn't sound like they will. I don't know of anybody who's having a party. It's sad. So I think COVID has provided a way for the globalists to hit back, and it's working for them at the moment, although there's several things going on at once. So it's hard to tell.
Do you think that the talk of a second strain, a mutation, has sort of, it's kind of like in a long-running drama where you have to keep introducing new elements in order to maintain the momentum. So you've got to keep changing the formula a bit. And I think you can see this with COVID. They introduced new ideas, and now we've got the new strain that everyone knew was coming. And now it's arrived, and it's up to the ante. And you know, the result of it is that you can't have a normal... I mean, you know... It does stagger me that so many people fall for this. I've got to say,
yeah, it's bleak. It's bleak. In that one way. But with the new strain, I mean, yeah, obviously, as far as I understand it, coronaviruses mutate. You know, that's just absolutely par for the course. And what I would say, in terms of how the authoritarians manage this, is that. It probably started mutating some time ago, but they pick the moment when they announce that it mutated, you know, things like that. And then, you know, this is the moment when we need to deal with this mutation, because the media is coordinated enough to do that.
Of course it is. All you need is a few press releases coming out of a few, clinics, a few medical think tanks, and that's all it would take.
Yeah, so I mean, it's what it is. It's I'm sure that it really is mutating. The viruses do, but it's a case of.
In these 90s disaster movies. You know, there was one that was Outbreak or something, and there was that. Yeah. There's a scene where they say, our worst fears that the virus is already bad enough, but our worst fears have come true. It's gone airborne, and now it. And it's much more transmissible now, as much of the danger. Oh, no. And it just reminds me of that, you know.
Was that the film that Blackpilled reviewed earlier this year or late last year? He did one about one of those movies like Outbreak, or there's another few similar ones. Outbreak was the Dustin Hoffman one, wasn't it? There was another one in the sort of late 2000s, early 2010s maybe. I watched it. It was all right. It was kind of boring. Blackpilled did a review of one of those and the subversive themes in it. And it must have been this year because he was relating it to the current crisis. Yeah. I recommend everyone watch that. I found that a very, very interesting video. I'm sure it was Blackpilled. One of the guys who does, thoughtful movie reviews. I think it was
I had him on, but we barely talked about COVID, so that wouldn't have come up. We were talking about the US election. So, that didn't come up, unfortunately. But people can go and search for that. I mean, he is fantastic. His stuff is excellent. I really like it.
Yeah. Absolutely crucial guy, yeah. And he related that, he spoke about it mostly through the lens of, I think, the producer, maybe the writer or director, who was a 60s radical. He was of, that ethnic origin. And the root of his life, where he'd been apparently a hippie, but at the same time, he'd actually been installed among hippies by the CIA, apparently. This guy went on to make this film, or be the driving force behind this film.
It's fucking unbelievable, isn't it?
It really, really, what it implies, I mean, it's one fact among a million, so don't place too much weight upon it, obviously, but... it implies that this could have actually been the product of a plan made decades ago. I mean, God knows. I mean, that's a little hard to believe for me, but I don't rule it out entirely,
I mean, I don't think it's... Well, decades, I think in the sense that they've been building up solidarity within the media, or the word for this? Not streamlining. There's a word for it. But anyway, they've been building up interconnectedness between the media, taking over media institutions and so on, so that now everything is off one mind. I mean, virtually. Even Fox News, as we recently discovered, is not actually this, what so many MAGA peds wanted it to be. But there, and the BBC transmits the correct message on everything. It's almost always in direct agreement with the government. Where I can recall at the time of the Iraq War, 2003, that was definitely not the case.
And there was a big conflict between the government and the BBC, which is, and you know, it was a left-wing government and the BBC, and there was a genuine conflict. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Exactly. It's very interesting from the perspective of nowadays, because we are now so accustomed to the situation where the BBC is just the voice of the government. It's just the PR arm of the British government. That was not always the case. And I think Americans in particular are often surprised by this, because they think, well, state media, you know, what do you expect? The BBC actually was detached from the government to a quite large extent. And still is in formal terms. But it still is in formal terms. It still has its independence, but in real terms, it's just the voice of the state at this point.
Well, and there's no real independence to it at all, as there isn't with the Bank of England. People said that Gordon Brown was a genius in 1997 for making the Bank of England quote independent, but it could just be shut down immediately by the state by the government if they wanted it to. So it's not independent. The BBC, likewise, it's chartered every 10 years. I think the next charter review will be in 2027. Obviously, 2017, it was renewed. It wasn't even debated in the media. That's another sign of the treason of the Tories. An outright left-wing or globalist institution that they just renewed without debate.
That's one that should definitely go to public referendum. I'm convinced that we would win it.
Yeah, and even if not, I mean, it would still be good just to have it debated, like, fiercely, two sides, you know, going at
it. Of course.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Of course.
I mean, the BBC, I think, comes under the Home Office. So my dream, it's a fantasy, and maybe, you know, maybe I'll get to fulfil it when I'm, like, 70 or something, is to be appointed Home Secretary. On the first day, I would close the BBC. The first morning, I would just assemble armed police and go in and shut down all their buildings and evict them and seize all their plants.
Couldn't you just put me in charge of it? And then it would be good.
A lot of people push back at me on this. I remember talking to Jackson when he was on European Freedom with us. And he said, well, no, but if you've got the power, you might as well use the BBC. And I can't dispute what he's saying, but I hate them so much. I dream of sending cops onto the set of Victoria Derbyshire's show as it's broadcasting. But I don't think she's on anymore. So they changed her job, so it wouldn't happen.
But I know exactly what you mean. And yeah, there are so many. It would be funny just to see them all just shut down. It's all over. You've been a bunch of bad people. So now you're all fired.
And then see if the other media responds smugly, and then shut them down as well using Ofcom. There you go. Boom. Take their license away from Sky, ITV. You're gone. You're off air. Bye. Go.
Yeah, it would be amusing.
We'd all be happier. We'd be a happier country if the top 20 or 30 media organisations in Britain were just shut down. We'd all be happier. We'd all be better off.
But this is the thing. Obviously, they have all been infiltrated, subverted. So, and not in the way that that might sound. I simply mean that you know, culturally, that's where they're all now useless. They're all now part of what we call global homo. So yeah, but the danger is though that if you shut them down, they'd just immediately be replaced by new rivals who were exactly the same. So I think in a way, Jackson might be correct that the thing to do is either to take them over and use them yourself, or enforce some kind. And this is what I think. I wish there was a way to do a similar thing with the social media companies. Force them to be impartial. But of course, this is a whole thing that we don't know how to do. This is never, as far as I know, this such a thing has never been demanded of an institution before in the sense that we mean. How can you force an institution to be impartial? And then you have to monitor how impartial it's being thereafter. Very difficult thing to do. I mean, I don't really know how you would do it. You'd have to have people from the far ends of the political spectrum and some people from the middle, And they'd all have to have equal weight in overseeing what that organization was doing.
And it would be a struggle. They'd all be struggling against each other, so it might not even work well. I don't think that you can have impartial media or maybe any institution. I'm not sure. I suppose there is a way for both Jackson and I to get what we want. For me, the main thing is sending the cops in. Or my friend History Bro, everyone should check out his channel. His vision is to send paratroopers in to like smash through the windows with their boots and stuff from the roof. But just for the drama of it, and just
the drama. That would be cool as well.
We can do that. Drive out all the existing people, seize all their files, their email addresses, and so on, cancel their pensions. That's very important to me. But then, you know, take a couple of weeks or whatever to find the staff, because, you know, most existing media people are going to be left wing. So we're going to need to, like, find a whole new media class. But then, yeah, reappoint them with orders to, you know, be nationalistic or whatever it is we want, you know.
I mean, honestly, and this might sound cucky off me, maybe it is, I'd be happy for them just to be impartial, just to put, like, you've got to make dramas that have that show all different kinds of people, you know, politically, and
you've also got to go Antifa.
Yeah, or you can have some characters who do, but you've also got to have some characters who don't, and you've got to, because this is the thing. I remember making a video in 2015 called The Dishonest Mirror. And I made the point that in dramas today, not just on the BBC, ITV as well, every character is a Guardian reader. Like every, and it's true. I mean, every, unless it's a villain, unless it's out, like an obvious villain character, then every reasonable, like just normal person is a Guardian reader. But there's nothing else.
And it's ridiculous. It's one of the lowest selling of the major newspapers.
Yes, but, and I'm not saying it's explicit. It's not explicit, but you can tell. You can tell, like, okay, which newspaper would this character be aligned with? And it's clearly The Guardian every time. Why? Because the people who write these things are all Guardian readers. Often Guardian writers as well, for that matter. So you see this bias all over the place. As I've said, it's a very difficult question, but I think there must be a way. I can't believe that this is an unsolvable problem. I just think you'd have to be very forthright about it.
The one thing I would say in news reporting, there's one way in which you cannot be objective, and that's in what do you select to report on. Even if your reporting on it is good, is very sincere and as objective as possible, which some of it still is, even at the BBC, like they do make some attempts at impartiality, but still the selection of what to report in that half hour or whatever, that is political. That is a political decision. This is more important than that. You know, I don't see any way to depoliticize that. So I don't know. I mean, you know, how do like dolphins get to the top of the Independence news reporting every day? You know, just like, I don't mean dolphins. I mean climate change. You know, but. We broke from the thick of it. He goes, we can't just put a picture of a dolphin on the front and just put outrage or something. We're not the Independent, for goodness sake.
I've never seen the thick of it, believe it or not. Yet another modern thing that I just haven't taken the time to watch.
I really, really like it. It started under Blair, and it's. I think I'd be interested to see what you think of it.
Wow, it's hard to believe it does go back that far, doesn't it? Yeah. But all right, I think we should probably be wrapping things up because I've got the next guest on in 30 minutes. But so the next note you've written here is you believe that globalism has gone into overdrive in this last year, in 2020. And we could say that they've panicked, but I think that would imply that it's one single organism. It's trying to become one organism, but it isn't there yet. So that's interesting. So globalism has gone into overdrive this year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying that very tentatively. I mean, to put a strong opinion on that would imply that I know what's going on, and I really only have, you know, some idea. So, my impression is that things are being done somewhat chaotically. And I mean that partly as an antidote to being depressed. Like, I mean, let's not think that the globalists are, you know, wholly organized.
Not Spectre from James Bond.
Yeah, I mean, because if globalism has caused the COVID crisis and used it against us, what kind of globalism is it that includes not only the West but also China? I mean, they are two genuinely separate ruling classes, as far as I can tell.
And I still don't understand what this is. You know, the whole thing with China at the start of this year, I still don't understand what was going on there and how it relates to the West. It might just be a happy accident that it benefited China to do this, and then it benefited the West to, or the Western elites, to run with it.
And in that could be one way in which the Western and Eastern ruling classes are gradually fusing together, perhaps, like they're beginning to realise commonalities between themselves, but they're also still in conflict. I think that is clear. I mean, you've got the sort of neocon wing of the Tory party this year periodically have just kept saying, right, we need to sue China for £1 trillion and all this stuff. And it's like, well, my response to that would just be like, China did not force our borders open. But that aside, I mean, that is a genuine conflict, I think, you know, and these are people, I say neocon, I don't really know. I mean, Owen Paterson was one of them. I don't know if he's a neocon. Maybe the neocon ones aren't. I'm not sure. But a large number of Tory MPs and Tory media and pundits and stuff have called for that, saying we need to be far more hostile to China because of this.
So we can benefit from what they've done, but we can also benefit in the other way by going to war with them.
Maybe talk about making
the most out of a crisis.
Well, yeah, actually, maybe I'm confusing matters here. Actually, when I think about it, Owen Paterson was a hard leaver, so maybe he's not at all typical. It wasn't just him. I mean, I can't remember, who was involved in this. But you are hearing. I mean, Alex Jones. God knows what his motivations really are, but he obviously likes to, you know, stir people against the Chinese. And
yeah,
it's the Chaikovs. Such a fat twat. I'm struggling to, like.
I mean, I just want to say that's Horace's opinion of Alex Jones. I don't share that condemnation. I am open minded about Alex on the AJ question. The AJQ, I guess.
Sorry, and also maybe I'm endangering your channel by attacking his weight as well. I don't know. Sorry.
Possibly.
But yeah, my answer to all this has to be that I sense my best and very tentative impression is that things are not fully under globalist control. We're not simply proceeding into their maw. You know, it's somewhat chaotic, and that is a reason for hope and for activism. So everyone just keep throwing around what weight you can, I would say, against the ruling class in general, using whatever angle you can, any way to land a blow on them. It's all good.
All right. Excellent. Well, let's leave it there then. This has been a very fun one. I've enjoyed it a lot. And I think the audience have as well, both on DLive and YouTube. It's very animated.
May I say one more thing before we go, just in reference to one of your streams a couple of nights ago, you mentioned the British Empire. I also have a slight nostalgia for 90s leisure centres.
Oh, good. I was worried that I was alienating myself by saying something so weird.
No, and I agree that the British Empire, that is really the only appeal of that fairly below par programme. And it was a waste of Chris Barry, who can be a very funny man, but, you know, often doesn't have the good roles. So.
If you look at his range in Red Dwarf, it's actually quite amazing how, you know, he is a very talented comedy performer.
He's good at pathos. He's good at a mixture of humor and pathos. I think he's very good at that. Rimmer, well, he's a good character, Rimmer, anyway, but the pathos side of Rimmer is really quite movie.
It really is. I mean, that scene in the second season where he talks about his father, they're in this, what's called the observation dome, which you only see once or twice ever, and it's very, very moving. So yeah, and there are other scenes as well, but that's the one that immediately comes to mind when I think about pathos. Okay, there are some super chats, actually. I almost forgot, sorry everyone. Okay, hi Horace, do you have any more interviews with Phil planned?
Yes.
Manchester, I can't work out how involved he is in this movement.
Yeah, I think, I can't speak for him, but yes, we are definitely doing at least one more chat, you know, we've got an actual plan for, and I'm sure there'll be more after that. Such an interesting guy, and he's also introduced me to a friend of his, who you'll see on the last chat that I did, which is called Karl Marx the nationalist. So yeah, I'm going to be doing more with them, definitely.
Okay. And someone says, if we ever take supreme power over any Western government, the first sweeping policy we must enact, which will be the biggest tide changing in this political war, must be... Okay, I agree, but I can't read that out on air. It's a bit sexist. Okay. So, all right. You can imagine what it relates to. All right. And then, oh, and there were some DLive things as well. Hold on a second. Okay. Frame Game, I looked for your other account. I honestly can't find it. So if I could, I would unban it, but I think you must have changed the name. So I can't find it on YouTube.
Is that Frame Game with Frame Game Radio?
I don't think so. I think it's a different one because I can't think it's the same guy.
He disappeared.
Yeah, he did. It's a shame, actually, but he was another one of those 2017 figures who emerged that year. It's a huge number of people who emerged in 2017. Anyway, Wisdom in Exile Radio. Good chat, lads. Merry Christmas to all. Well, yes, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. Thank you. And then someone else says, Ich bin hier, die Anglos zu infiltrieren, which translates as, I am here to infiltrate the Anglos. Thank you very much. Actually, no, I don't think he wants to infiltrate the Anglos. I think he wants to wipe us out.
I do like that, though. He's a good
guy. And then Contentious Rhetoric talks about us taking over the BBC, and he says, endless Withnail and I reruns.
Oh. Damn. Before this chat, I wanted to ask if I could have as the intro music Marwood Walks from Withnail and I. But if anyone's not heard that, it's a 2-minute piece of brilliantly melancholic music. I love it.
Yes, I think I do know the one, and it is lovely. Yeah, I mean, Withnail and I wouldn't have endless reruns of it. I'd have other things made off in that ilk, where it's, a small budget and talented actors and talented writers and a good director. It's just the stuff that the British can make with very few resources. Like Withnail and I, a couple of million pounds. And, that's nothing in terms of, the budgets of today. So, you can make loads of Withnail and I's. And I think it's criminal that we're not doing that.
But, masterpiece. A brilliant film.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm glad. Nice to end on a pleasant note like that, after all the hardcore stuff we've been talking about. So, okay, well, thank you very much, Horace, for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Thank you. It's been an ambition of mine since I first started making videos, so thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, that's great. You're welcome. All right, I'll be back in half an hour with Lone Wolf, I believe it is. Yes. So I'll see you then. In the meantime, thank you, Horace, and I'll see you all later. Bye for now.